Welcome everyone on another On Point podcast today. I am really pleased to be meeting with our guest, who is one of the top influencers in commercial real estate and AI, and whose latest thing on Substack blew me away when you were talking about an apocalypse. Anthony, you've been in real estate for over 25 years, and I'm sure you've seen all the intersection of property and technology. What are you seeing? What's keeping you up at night at the moment?
It's really interesting. I started such a long time ago. So I had my first commercial real estate website in 1995 to 98. Was incredibly exciting. Everything was changing. Every week there was something new. It was just absolutely fantastic. And then it all sort of settled down and just became very, very hypey. And then it all, of course, blew up in the, what is it, 2000, wasn't it? But it's only since the last 3 years, so since November the 30th, 22. Yeah, my God, it's nearly 4 years now. It will be 4 years in November with the rise of all this generative AI. It has just been incredibly exciting. And what amazes me is it just seems to be getting faster and faster and faster, which is genuinely a little bit unnerving. And it's interesting watching, you've even got people like Andre Karpathy, who's one of the original gods of AI, one of the world's great AI researchers, writing a few weeks ago, saying that just between November and January, his workflows moved from being roughly 20% with the machine, if you like, and 80% him coding, to the reverse. Because of the release of new products. And when you've got someone of that stature saying, I can let it do quite a lot of my coding, then when you come down to, you know, more mortal land, you start thinking, my God, there's really something quite dramatic going on here.
Well, I joined one of your cohorts, and ever since then been part of the group and, you know, the thing that Dan does. And I think he posted something about the rent a human. Actually, the agents employing humans, and I thought, oh my God, this is...
There's a role reversal for you. But I'll tell you something which is a bit more scary. As it stands, it looks like the top four companies will spend $600 billion this year on CapEx of equipment, having spent over $400 billion this year. I mean, these numbers are so ridiculous, aren't they? You have a budget where everyone goes on about it. Across the whole country, are we going to be able to find 20 billion? And they're talking about spending, four companies spending 200 and then 600 billion. But someone pointed out that I was listening to yesterday was that you do not spend $600 billion on CapEx unless you think the market is much more than software. Because the software market in the US is about $300 billion a year. You do not spend $600 billion in a year to own a market of $300 billion. But the market for labor in the US is several trillion. So when it really comes down to it, even though it's generally not said, the point of a lot of this technology is to do the work of humans and to substitute for humans. Otherwise, there is no rationale in spending that much money. So all of which might not be a problem if we get the growth that a lot of the tech bros think will be a natural consequence of all this new technology. But if we don't get considerable growth and we're not sharing out a bigger pie, then the potential ramifications are rather more complicated, let's say.
Well, yeah, I mean, going back to... I'd like to say 1995, I remember going, people standing on stage and saying that automation was actually, in terms of just in factory space, was going to take away 60% of the jobs. And I know in my industry, I remember in China, like in Germany, they had CNC machines for the curtain wall industry. You know, and if you had one of these things, it's a big deal. Whereas at the same time, an equivalent company had 60 in China. And so just that alone, if you say 60% of jobs, then in 95, a billion people, I know, you know, you do all the math because half of them are only of working age, but it's still a chunk of people that were taken out just from automation, from the type of things that Amazon are doing with, you know, their plants. So another layer of technology like AI and AGI, I think it's going to be devastating. although I'm still, you know, in the industry we're in, sort of commercial real estate, and we're still bricks and mortar, we've still got hands on, we're still doing tactile surveys, doing repairs and maintenance. Technology is, I don't think, is going to take over that quickly, although I have seen drones cleaning buildings just recently.
I think that's definitely true. I mean, in many ways, because the industry is linked to physical assets, nasty, dirty physical assets.
Yeah.
And the structure of the industry is more relationship built than data built, frankly.
Yeah.
It's going to take a long time, except one always has to take in account. And this is the bit that interests me. Is, I'm in many ways less bothered about what happened, what the real estate industry thinks is going to happen, than what's going to happen to their customers. So, you know, in terms of what's the future of offices, what's the future of industry, what's the future of, you know,
your space,
energy. Yeah, and yes, exactly, energy infrastructure. You know, the way we, the real estate we're going to need and the way we use it, it is going to change fundamentally. And I think what is likely to happen is that the real estate industry at last is actually going to have to change faster than it has done. Not because it wants to, but because it's simply going to be forced to. I mean, not least of all in your world, I would imagine looking at the whole costs of maintenance and construction and labor and all that, you've got to find more efficient and less expensive ways of doing stuff, haven't you?
Well, I think that's true, certainly for new build. You know, our sweet spot is buildings that are sort of like 15, 20 years old. You know, I love the iconic buildings of London. I was sort of explaining to someone the other day, I've just come back from a site where it's watching, you know, like £20 million cars racing around.
I saw a mention of that. That sounded great.
It was fantastic. And Lord Foster gave an award. He designed an award. And which made me think about the whole thing about the iconic buildings. You know, there's so much effort goes into restoring cars, looking after them so that they can be, they're not just show queens. I mean, these are people who are serious about their cars and were really prepared to put them out on the ice, you know, and, you know, potentially even, you know, the Bugattis and Ferraris and Alphas, all the top brands. And we've got iconic buildings, and I don't think we are considering them in the same way, that we want them to work for a long time. We're not just going to knock down, I won't name them, but some of the iconic buildings that need inspection. They need proper integration within the digital twins with all the AI stuff that's out there, IoT. But ultimately, it needs physical hands-on tactile stuff with drones, with thermals, with facade engineers, with consultancies to make sure that they're still there in another 20 years. So I wonder, in a world where AI is moving so fast, and commercial real estate deals and transactional space needs some kind of normalization so it can rely on providence. So if you sell a building today, you need to do all your inspections. You need to have, there is no MOT for the facade. You know, you wouldn't get a car and without an MOT, you wouldn't be allowed to. And yet you can buy or sell a building and the skin of the building is really important. That's where all the risk is. And there's no MOT. And everyone's talking about post-Grenfell stuff. And I'm just thinking, where's the seriousness? Where is the commercial real estate seriousness that says we're going to do something? And that's before we have layers of AI, before we have technology, just the thought process. Insurers actually saying, well, I'm going to, my insurance has gone through the roof, and I'm sure everyone else is. But if I owned a building that was 20 stories up, I'd want to go insure and say, well, I've been regularly maintaining this.
Yeah.
And prove it. Surely my insurance can come down. I don't know if you're seeing any of those conversations in any of the things that the people you're working.
This is a little bit of a hobby horse of mine, actually. And I wrote about it shortly before Christmas. The idea, I was talking to someone about data rooms. And when they sell a building, they say, oh, we'll set up a data room. And goes, oh, that sounds very clever, doesn't it? But basically, a data room is just a file folder on a shared PC somewhere. But it's an useful way for people to aggregate information. And I was saying, you know, the whole thing is ridiculous. You have these really expensive assets, and then people are trying to trade them. But because everything behind the asset is so opaque and so archaic, it takes you months and months to do stuff. and months to do stuff when you're talking about a £100 million asset is worth a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I was saying, it just seems so obvious that now we're getting to the stage of really, it's not that hard to completely sensorize a building. You know, sensors are cheap. You can put them on everything. You can monitor everything in a building. And I was saying, really, a data room should be a dynamic live feed of how this building works, updates all the time. So if I want to come and buy a building from you, you just point me at the data room and it tells me immediately exactly how it's performing, what's the likely upgrade, what am I going to need to spend next year? And then you'd be able to trade straight away. And you think, it sounds sort of quite sci-fi, but really it's pretty basic. It's really not, shouldn't be that hard. You know, all these systems, you're connecting all these systems, you've got cheap sensors, you've now got a layer of AI which can easily just be sent off. Here's a whole set of agents, go and visit these 400 sensors and visit them every 10 minutes and write the information back into this thing. And you can do that, you know, no labor involved. And that's the way we should be thinking about buildings. Have, as you say, a facade of a 20-story building, which you really no idea anything about it, is ludicrous. As you say, you can't put a car on the road without it being checked every year. And, you know, I think AI is going to act as the forcing function that actually pushes this to happen. Because at some stage, you are going to get from the finance side, who are used to having immediate access to any information they want available, are going to say, oh, come on, industry. We don't have to put our money into real estate. We can put it somewhere else, you know. So give us an asset that we can actually trade properly. And sooner or later, I think people will say, well, you know, I've got a really great asset. Really? Can you prove it? Yeah. You have a look.
Yeah.
You have a look at my asset and then go and have a look at their asset. And I'll tell you, my asset's better than their asset. And at the moment, you can't do that. So a broker said to me, you know, you put two buildings in front of a buyer, identical buildings next door to each other. And you say, well, which one do you want to buy? And he said, frankly, we make lots of things up and we do lots of due diligence, but basically it's a eeny, meeny, miny, mo sort of decision. Whereas it should be, here's my spec. I perform against these KPIs at 98% efficiency. Here's my spec. I'm a bit grubby. And that would change so much.
That's what I'm saying. I'm glad it's a hobby horse, because I think it's going to turn in the whole industry, because I mean, that's why we've been building the whole FIMS thing, the facade information. It's because we want to give clients predictable models, both for CapEx, for APE, X and CapEx. You know, like, to have a digital twin for maintenance, you know, I know we did something, well, God, it's like 3 years ago now with Nick Wern, which I know you know, and we literally built a model that engineers could visit and diagnose even before they get to site. So the efficiency of that was really good using the technology of the time. But I think for estate owners, I'm seeing that. I mean, I work with a lot of the facade engineers and they all, I think, want the same thing. They want this standard. I mean, I see it as based off ISO 15686, because I think that's what's baked in from the beginning. But after the operators have taken over, no one ever refers to it. And I think service life and estimated service life are key. And we're getting the information in. And if we were to put it into, like, that's what I've been, you know, you talk about hobby horse, you've spent hundreds of thousands, still nowhere with that platform, because AI keeps changing. That's the thing. Like, every time I'm sitting on one of the WhatsApp groups, someone's gone, have you tried this? And then you've got to have the load, capacity to go, right, okay, let me park everything I've known. Now let me go and venture off into whatever Claude, Anthropic, or anything anyone else has done and see how it improves what I've got.
But you have been building all your foundations, though, haven't you?
Yeah.
This is the thing. It's like, you know, I would always say to, like, real estate companies, it doesn't really matter that I can guarantee you there'll be a different model in 6 months' time and something new will happen. In the meantime, build out your base level of your data. Because if you've got that, everything else is just plug and play. Once you've got, you know, your beautiful data lake, and it's all in, ideally in a knowledge graph, and it's a, you know, it's a thing of beauty. You can plug anything into it, and we know it's only if you've got that, then everything new that happens actually is a bonus. It just means you can do more. But if you haven't done that foundational work, so you get lots of people going, oh, well, I'm not going to pay too much attention to it now because you're telling me it's all going to change in 6 months. So I don't want to learn about it now. I'll learn about it in 6 months' time. It's partly based on machine learning. And the point is, it's in the learning. And you're building up this base layer, and then you're building up, you're thinking about, if I was able to do X, then I could do Y. And then it'll be plug and play. So I think I can understand the frustration of it changing all the time, but the investment in the base layer is a massive differentiator, because most people don't do it, because it's frankly boring as hell, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, sorting out all your data is the dullest job in the world, and no one wants to do it.
Well, I people say to me, why are you so passionate about O&Ms? And I just think, you know, the quality of data equals the quality of work. You know, if you've got good information, you can do, you know, when you're talking about trying to do a repair at 20 floors up at night, you need good quality of information. So we've invested in tech, for headsets, so we can talk to the engineer while he's up there. But it's not a lot of people, you know, get that. They don't get, you know, how important the IKEA drawing is. As men, we just tend to throw them away. You know, and then we're left with a bag of irons, you know, screws and bolts. But, I mean, in a service-led real estate model, I mean, how important do you think is long-term building performance, transparency? You know, we talked about this, that golden thread thing. How important do you think that is?
I mean, I've sort of been saying the same thing for decades, but it should be incredibly important. And I do feel convinced that you're going to get to the stage that if you haven't got this transparent data, no one's going to want to deal with you. Not least of all, because a lot of the dealing now is actually going to be my agent to your agent. So we'll get our agent, you know, that old joke of I'll get my people to speak to your people. Well, it's going to be, I'll get my agent to speak to your agent, let them do their stuff. And then when they've done the stuff, we'll get together and finish it off. So there's going to be a massive amount of... I heard a good description, and it's partly in that PropTech Apocalypse article I wrote this morning. This idea of we are moving to a world where we're going to be substituting... And this is the world of, you know, software in particular. Human plus machine to machine plus API to agent plus API. So... the joke about the SaaS thing is the SaaS companies sell you something, some software, but the software doesn't actually do anything unless you attach it to a human who pushes some buttons. Whereas what you have with an agent, if I'm selling you an agent and I give it access to XYZ APIs, it can do stuff. It does stuff straight away. So once we start moving into that world where that just becomes the default way of dealing with so many things, the idea of then having an asset that you can't interrogate and know about will seem like the dark ages. So I genuinely think we're moving to a stage where it is going to become very important very quickly. Not least of all, because I mean, I mainly deal in the office. Other asset classes are available, and maybe you should be dealing in other asset classes. But if you think of the future of offices, I only see the future of two set types of office. The prime top end office, which will be let to the best wealthy multinational companies. Who don't really get them. The money's not important to them. They just want a really good building with all the bells and whistles and they can afford it. And if you take London at the moment, there's a massive shortage of those. So everyone's going on about, oh, everyone's charging back to the office market. They're not. They're charging back to the top bit of the market because they suddenly realize there's 20% of demand is looking for a product which now doesn't exist. Because no one's been building anything for the last few years, and there's nothing due for the next few years. So that top end of it is very strong. And then I think variants on flexible spaces are going to be very, very strong. Not least of all, because we've still got this we haven't dealt with this fundamental thing that we now use our offices basically 3 days a week, but we're signing to use them for 7 days a week. And sooner or later, someone's going to go, hang on a moment, why am I paying for 5 working days? I'm only there for 3. So I need a different product. You need to tell me something different. So I think there's whole variance on the flex market, which will give people what they want when they want it. And then there's all that stuff in the middle, which is going to be obsolete because it's just going to be space that no one wants. So the flex operators and the top operators will only be able to operate at the level they need to if they're fully teched up, as it were. So they will need to. So the product that's going to do well is going to be much, much more technologically advanced. So I think it's just going to become a byproduct of that. You know, you have a really high performing building, and that building can describe itself and is transparent. So, you know, I think.
So what you're saying, the bigger challenge isn't just technology, it's trust. Trusting the information. Because as you said, you know, there are data lakes everywhere, you know, and then data rooms, but now we're actually having the building speak for itself because it's referencing itself through sensors, agents, APIs. We're still going to have a layer of people that can interpret that information.
Yeah.
Know how that's going to thing, but it's like, who do you trust?
The trust layer is incredibly important. I mean, I think for a lot of the real estate industry, certainly the professional services types company, there's 3 layers to a future business model. So one is data. What data do you either have access to that's your own, or that you've aggregated and you know how to pull together, and you can aggregate as and when you need. So you don't necessarily need to be sitting on, you know, Blackstone levels of proprietary data. It would be nice, but just being able to pull together all the data you can as and when you need it. So there's a data layer, and then there's the whole orchestration layer, which is building up of all these systems that we're using to do our operations. And how well we can orchestrate all of those. Thinking of your facades, you know, you sort out the drains, you sort out the headsets, you've got all the kit and you're managing all the kit. So it all turns up as and when it's needed. And then the third layer is exactly as you say, who do you trust? And so when I give you these data points, you can have trust that I am giving you accurate, certifiable, citation ready information. And that's going to be enormously valuable, but actually quite hard to do, because if you actually really need to stand behind your data, then you really have to have control of your data, don't you? You can't just pull it in and, you know, it's got to be accurate and you've got to be able to cite it, et cetera, et cetera. And that's going to be a huge function of the way a company works that verifies at each step. So one of the things I was looking at a couple of weeks ago, you know, this idea of, you know, agents were working together. So the idea you have, say, 7 different agents, and they're each doing a little part of a workflow, and each one is 95% accurate. Well, you think, well, that's fine, 5%. I can deal with the 5%. But if you do 7 steps at 95% accuracy, you're down to 40% accuracy. So unless you are verifying when agent 1 passes off to agent 2, who passes off to agent 3, either algorithmically or by sticking a human in the loop, nothing works. So you've got, the more you think about automating processes, the more important verifiability is. And that's going to be hard. But if you can crack that, then that's really, really really powerful stuff, particularly in real estate, because I think that needs a certain mindset and a certain attention to data quality that people generally don't have. So those with the attention to detail and the rigor are going to stand out and are going to have a jump start. You know, it's not like the finance industry, where you can pretty well guarantee, you know, you go to JP Morgan or you go to Merrill Lynch or you go to Goldman Sachs, they've all got pretty damn good data, and you know it's pretty damn good data. It's not like that in real estate, is it? You know, you pick 3 companies and say who's got good data.
I think the one word which I remember going to a show about 5 years ago, and it was the word interoperable. So when you do a repair, to be able to put back that into a model, so it's interoperable, so you leave an audit trail. So you almost, and it'd be even better if it was blockchain and immutable, but to leave your mark on there that says Rod was here and he was the one who changed this, or
yes,
the crew or whatever. And the same as like the old stonemasons would say, so you knew, yep, who was doing it. I mean, we're so aligned on what we're thinking, but how do we encourage building owners and managers to invest in the kind of data and things like FIMS that we've been talking about, do you think?
It's quite hard for the supply side to do it. We do need the demand side to actually step up and demand the sort of quality that they should be demanding, which is basically the investment market. I mean, it is a bit of a laugh, isn't it? You know, the investment market is forever going on about how clever and sophisticated their financial models are, and they can understand returns to two decimal places 10 years out. And you know, it's absolute bunkum. It's complete, but then they don't demand actually knowing, is the bloody facade going to fall off, or, you know, is it going to go up in flames, or if it does go up in flames, what are we going to do about it, and that sort of thing. So I think a lot of it, I think a lot of this has to go around storytelling, in the sense of we just got to continually repeat that the way we work enables you to go X, Y, Z, and then do it again. And eventually the customer will go, you mean I can just, if I just look, it will tell me, you know, ABC. And go, yeah, that's what I do. Oh, wow. That took me ages before. So the more we can demonstrate to people, as you say, accurate, transparent, real-time or near real-time data, and which enables us to do projections, the more I think eventually, certainly the smarter end of the market will go, well, that's got to be the way to do it. Because you can explain this down, overall it's more expensive to do it really well technologically than your costs over a number of years when you haven't got any information, and you know all the money you spend on tech, if you don't spend it, probably gets eaten up in wasted time and buying the wrong thing and all this sort of stuff.
100%. I think it, and I've proved it to clients, and we've done some massive inspections that have led to good quality decision making. I mean, that's the thing, when you have a model that you can share and bring people to innovate, everyone can see, you know, when you show some failures on a building, when I say failures you catch, I mean, even something like a short gasket is, it deteriorates over time. It allows water to get in. That reduces, you know, your sealed units are going to be sitting water. You know, thermal cracking can occur. All the sort of like side effects of that. And when you say, look, all we need to do is just change the gasket, and that's going to increase 5 years, which means, you know, things like that. But I think, so without a shadow, capturing that and putting it into, let's call it your data room, that has some intelligence built into it, and is structured in a way that actually key stakeholders can interrogate it really quickly and has some accountability. But I think there's no regulation for it. I mean, I think increasing regulation is coming because of the Building Safety Act. But could AI reduce compliance risk? Could the insurers say, okay, we're going to discuss with government? I mean, it's crazy. You can the millions that are spent in getting planning, getting a building to planning, and then all the drawings go in and all the justifications and everything else. Once it's built, the planning portals, no one checks anything. So I think they, you know, there's a missing step. You know, again, going back to the MOT of stars, I just think it's the easiest thing to understand, because, you know, a stitch in time always saves nine. You know, like, so someone telling you, you know, about your tires, or, you know, you've got your exhaust or anything about the car, someone tells you early enough about the building, you can do something about it, restore the integrity. Everyone feels good about it. You know, people going into a building are choosing to work in smarter looking.
Yeah.
The light causes is a big factor. So if you've got something that's an old 70s tinted bronze window,
yeah,
you know, it's not a great environment to work in. I can see why they were doing it, but today we've got modern glasses that will do solar control and all the rest of it.
Yeah, well, you would have thought that people would. I think people are paying more attention. You know, what assets are actually going to let well? then they're not going to be that 1970s building. It's just not going to let very well, is it? But I think it's the great thing that AI is going to be able to do is sit at this meta layer above. Well, this is why one of the reasons why all the SaaS companies suddenly dropped in price a couple of weeks ago in America. You know, they lost $300 billion in a day, because suddenly people realized you don't necessarily need to go into these systems to work with them, because you can just send your agent to go and look at all of them, because the agent can sit and run your computer in the same way as you do. So, for instance, and you know, a classic in CRE world, if you think, I'll ask anyone how much they like working with Yardi or MRI. Everyone hates it. Everyone hates it. I mean, they're fantastic businesses and they're solid as a rock, but they're hateful systems to actually work with. So if you said to someone, you're never going to have to fire up Yardi and go looking for things in the future, you're going to have a lot of happy people, because the agent can just go and do it. That's actually quite unlikely to happen, because Yardi being Yardi doesn't let anyone in, and there just is this walled garden. But in many systems, there's going to be a lot of advantage to having open APIs. So I want to plug into your ecosystem. So you take a facade, I don't know, it might have 10 different companies supplying different things, but they've all got to work like an ecosystem, haven't they? That everyone can talk to everyone else.
Their economy is going to demand it.
100%. But if you have a circular economy like that, you can then ask the question of, what is my CapEx expenditure likely to be next month on these three buildings? And it looks it up, and it looks what's likely to fail. And it then looks from there to, well, how much is the replacement, and how long is it going to take to order? And then how much is Joe the fitter to come and do it? And it can come back to you and say, well, it's going to 15 and a half grand you're going to have to spend next week, because they all talk to each other. And that's such a consumer surplus if you can build these systems. So I do think it's really incumbent on smaller, more independent suppliers to try and plug in to their complementary ecosystem, because you will get the Yardies of the world CoStar, who'll just say, no, you can't take any information out, and no one can programmatically put it back in unless you give us loads of money. They're just walled gardens, but they've got you by the short and curlies, because they're the keep of the master record. So you have to deal with them, and they can behave as badly as they like, but you have to deal with them. The advantage is going to come when you can build an ecosystem of suppliers that is very easy to plug and play, that I do like working with, that is more transparent, more open, quicker, faster, probably cost me less than this other system. And it's not that I won't still keep using this legacy system, but I use it less, or I won't use it for these things, because I've now got, if you like, modern suppliers who can do that. And you've got, you know, what it's like. There's people like you in each vertical who are leaning into how can we do something 10x better than we've done before. And it's okay, it's not the norm, but people like you exist in every vertical. They've got to work together. You know, 2 + 2 = 5 if they can all. Because the AI does the coordination. You couldn't do that. A lot of this stuff you couldn't do in a human world, because I can't sit there and talk to 12 different people. It just takes me too long. If I've got to phone 12 different people, it's too long. I'll just give me one phone number of a monolith who I don't like dealing with, but it's only one number. But if my agent is doing it, I don't care. I'll talk to 100 people all the time. And so the agent and the AI does the coordination. And if you can coordinate new things and create new value, or coordinating new things is what you need to do to create new value. And people will start thinking and working like that. Well, if I could plug that into that, 2 + 2 = that's 5 there. But it's not just going to happen.
No. It takes time. It takes time. And I think it takes confidence. And part of the reason why, you know, I've loved this chat, but I've, you know, just watching, you know, you talk on the LinkedIn, because you're going ahead. You know, your thing is the space of service. you know, you, I don't know, I get the impression that you're encouraging property owners to think more like operators.
And yeah, absolutely.
Embrace the whole thing of AI. And then when someone's out there going, well, you should try this, and, you know, like, and all the other groups that we're part of, and Dan speaking and stuff like that, it gives you confidence. But you have to invest the time. God knows, thousands of hours already, you know, like, yeah, that brain bursting, trying to make this work, and then it doesn't work. And luckily, we've got some younger techies in the company from that surveying world, but want to also...
But it's having the domain knowledge. If you can combine really deep domain knowledge with the right attitude and the willingness to push the technology, that 100% is 2 + 2 = 5. It really is, because it's a classic prop tech thing, isn't it? Everyone said, you know, for 25 years, the trouble is prop tech people know nothing about real estate, and real estate people know nothing about tech. But I mean, this is... it's changing quite a lot, but I think that the capabilities now, or the opportunities for someone with deep domain knowledge who's interested and curious for these new tools, you're trying to get a flywheel going. You know, I mean, you watch those people on the speed racing cycling. They go so slow because you can't get the damn thing going, and then it builds. But if you can get that domain knowledge technology flywheel going, I think you just look at the capabilities of what you can do just with, I don't know, Claude code now. You don't have to code, just ask it. Go to my, a good example, I was actually showing my wife the other day how it works. And I said, look, there's this podcast that I've been told it's really, really good, and I want to catch up on it. They've got 90 episodes. So I just use Claw Code, and I say, can you go and find all these 90 episodes, download them into this folder? And then, so it downloaded, did that, fine, tick, 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 done. And then I said, oh, can you now transcribe them all for me? Bish, bash, bosh, did it, sat on its own for a couple of hours and did that. Once you start having these types of capabilities, then you really have suddenly got to a stage where you're thinking, well, my God, there's stuff I can do today that I couldn't do 12 months ago. And that's going to be demonstrably better than my competitors.
Notebook has transformed, you know, like when you can dump the information into notebook, and, you know, some of the speed, because you can interact with it, and, you know, you've got a real thinking partner there, you know.
Yeah.
That's
what I did with these transcripts. I put them all into notebook.
Right.
And then did some analysis of, you know, what's the big deal in this area that they've been talking about, and which companies have they been talking about, and that sort of thing. And then suddenly, bang, you know, you're pretty well informed.
Do you think prompt engineering is still number one skill?
Yes. Yeah, I do. Not in the sense of, and Anthropic, who are the main makers of Claude, put out some research a couple of weeks ago where they showed there's an almost direct correlation between the, what they call the educational quality of an input and the educational quality of an output. So if you have a high schooler level prompt or a PhD level prompt, you'll get a PhD level response or a high school level response. And everyone has this assumption, and I hear it all the time, it drives me nuts, that, oh, well, these systems just give you the average of everything. So that's why it's generic. It's just the average of everything. The reason you give the average of everything is because you put a very average question in there. The ability to ask a really good question, which is frankly all prompt engineering is, has such a demonstrable impact on the answer. And what I did one this morning, actually, there was something I wanted to research. And I went to Gemini and I basically wrote out a paragraph of what it was I wanted to do. And I thought, I know I'm not explaining what I actually, I'm not quite sure what I want the answer to cover. So I then just gave it back to Gemini and said, here's my prompt. I would like you to optimize it for a deep research to give to you in deep research mode. And it came back with a beautiful, about a page, explicitly saying that the research needs to look at this, and then the output needs to cover blah, 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 blah. And you get a fantastic answer. So it's not the thing about prompt and we're not really talking about prompt real prompt engineering, which is on the technical side, but just the ability to write a good prompt and to understand that you will get a better answer out than if you don't. But there's also the thing, they call it context engineering now, which is the other thing of understanding that now all of the models have got very big context windows. So the context window, for people who don't know, is just, if you like, what you've got in just your at-hand memory. So 2 plus 2, oh, it's 4. 5 plus 5, 10. It's your fast response RAM, if you like. Now, you know, new Claude's got a million token, which is about 700,000 words. So you can put a huge amount of information, background information, and then ask a question of it, which is exactly what Notebook LM does. Allows you to put massive amount of information and then ask a question of it. And the quality of your context, so pulling together the right information to give it, to understand, to get a good answer from this, I need to give it these inputs, understanding that. And most people aren't very good at that, of understanding, well, you're not going to get a good answer unless you can put XYZ in. And writing a good clear prompt is massively valued. You know, the payoff from just writing a good prompt and having some experience of the different techniques you can use is
is
a hundredfold.
I mean, as Timothy Leary said back in the 60s, it's all about set and setting or content. It depends on the trip you're going to have if you have the right content.
Well, Timothy Leary in the context of AI, it sort of makes sense, actually.
Well, do you know, there is a link. I'm just trying to think. There is a link, but we digress. I want to ask you, you started off as an art dealer, I believe. And I know you're tied for time. I want to be respectful of your time, but you went from art dealer into this world, and like having your time again and seeing where AI has gone, what do you think? Is there something you would have done with art and AI?
I don't know. The art world's the most fantastic world, but it helps if you're already very rich. It's really, again, it's a gentleman's fantasy to operate in the art world, and it's great fun. But, you know, it is quite interesting now. You know, they say that there's a line of AI is the revenge of the humanities graduate, because who can string a good sentence together? There's an awful lot of techies who can't string a sentence together. You know, they can barely talk. Whereas an English graduate, which everyone derided for years, is now can write really good prompts. But, you know, but there's also the point that thinking about the world we're going into, we're clearly becoming more and more technological, but I think that's going to mean we have to become more and more human, because we really do need to be able to do what the machines can't do. So, you know, I use that tagline of, you know, hashtag human is the new luxury. In a lot of services, I was giving a talk actually last week to a whole group of people in purpose-built student accommodation. And I said, ultimately, the winners will be those who can marry invisible reliability, in the sense of everything just works, all your networking, everything just works, with visible care.
Listen, that's what we do best, is care. We care for buildings.
Exactly. I mean, it's sort of perfect in your situation. That is the point, isn't it? You know, enabling you to give the care requires all this technological, and then that's what we're going to do, and that's what we're going to get paid for. So, you know, having, you know, 5 years ago, everyone said you need to be a coder, didn't they? And that hasn't aged too well, has it? Having really good human skills, I don't think you're going to
I think that
be downgraded very quickly.
I think that's always going to be the case. Antti, thank you for your time. I've got a feeling this is going to be the first of many. Because I sit and talk to you for hours, you're font of all knowledge. Thank you again for your time.
No problem. I'm very happy to come back on any time. It's really, really, really good to talk with you.
Appreciate that.